Chapter 3. Control Everything. Own Nothing. Imagine the Possibilities. Wyoming Corporate Services. Most of the audiences S.D. Wu encountered when traveling had never heard of Delaware, or knew anything about the state. Even most Americans would be hard-pressed to rattle off more than a few facts, if any, about the state. One of the smallest, and in terms of national coverage, least consequential of the American states, Delaware hardly has any cultural imprint or any real legacy in the broader American story, beyond being the first state to ratify the U.S. Constitution. Aside from President Joe Biden, Delaware's rarely produced a figure of any renown, a remarkable achievement considering it was one of the original 13 colonies. Where most states have clear associations, Texas and cowboys, Oregon and timber, Louisiana and jazz, Delaware is known for, in effect, nothing, which, for those searching for anonymity, makes it the perfect place to help hide their ill-gotten gains. What better place to stash your funds than a state few ever think about? The story of Delaware's transformation into one of the world's leading kleptocratic havens is one that's decades, even centuries, old. But in order to trace how Delaware transformed into the heart of the U.S.'s role in the offshore-onshore world, how the state became, as one former SEC chair described, a pygmy state interested only in revenue, you have to cycle back to the early days of the American Republic, and you have to focus less on the role Delaware played in propelling the U.S. Constitution to ratification, and more on how the earliest days of American capitalism operated. In the lead-up to the American Revolution, companies created in the American colonies, still under the thumb of authorities in London, were overseen by the colonies themselves. Soon thereafter, once the Americans successfully declared independence, those new American states opted to retain the same oversight structures. Dealing with plenty else, national security, foreign policy, the structures of American government itself, early American legislators simply opted to keep this company oversight system in place, with the states. The best historical evidence, one academic study found, indicates that after the American Revolution, the state legislatures simply followed the precedent of the colonial assemblies. Companies formed in those early days of the American Republic were, likewise, far closer to their British precedents than anything we see in 21st century America, and they were far more restricted in what they could do than their modern counterparts. Early corporate structures in the U.S. remained largely limited to things like educational institutions and charitable organizations and, oddly, cemeteries. Indeed, corporations themselves were far rarer than they would eventually become. As one corporate historian wrote, they were very uncommon. Looking at the kinds of early regulation involved in setting them up helps explain some of this scarcity. Each early American corporation required its own separate bill to pass through state legislatures before it could operate, a remarkably onerous procedure just to create a corporation. If states still employed this setup, their state legislatures would never get anything else done. Legislatures eventually looked for a way to streamline the process. By the 1830s, proposals arose for transferring company oversight from the state governments to the federal government, unburdening state legislatures from overseeing the process. But by that time, Jacksonian populists, the kind suspicious of federal power, except when it came to things like the ethnic cleansing campaigns targeting Native American populations at least, ruled the federal government, and they wanted to keep Washington's hands off corporate formation. So those supporting reform efforts tried a different approach. If they couldn't get Washington to oversee corporate formation, why not just decrease the regulatory burdens on the states? And that's exactly what began happening, and in a very real sense, only continued happening in the century and a half following. Through the remainder of the 19th century, those onerous requirements for setting up an American corporation slowly waned. Gone were the requirements to pass a bill for every single corporation. Gone were the hearings and the debates over each and every new company. While Congress occasionally agitated for more control over the process, including in the aftermath of the Civil War amidst massive civil rights reforms, populist voices still didn't want the federal government to consolidate oversight. Better, they thought, for states to retain control. Much of that stemmed from the developing American ethos of restricting the federal government's hand in the country's economics. As one researcher summarized, many of those who understood how business and corporations operated still trusted the state and local free market to provide the proper level of regulations and, therefore, never would have considered pushing for increased federal oversight and control over corporations. During the late 19th century, amidst broader economic transitions and trajectories that would end in the Gilded Age and the ensuing Progressive Era, corporate formations entered a new epoch. While monopolies grew to dominate industries like steel and oil, one state began dominating the company formation industry, but it wasn't Delaware. New Jersey, just north of Delaware, had long been economically dominated by New York. But by the 1870s, New Jersey realized that rolling back corporate formation regulations could be just the financial solution needed to help boost its own economy. In order to entice this new corporate business, new corporations that New Jersey could tax and require fees from, helping boost the state budget, the state passed a slate of reforms. Previously, corporate charters had been limited to a few decades, but in New Jersey, state legislators removed chronological caps on new corporations, allowing them to remain in perpetuity. Legislators also moved to allow companies to hold stock in other companies, a move that allowed the creation of so-called holding companies, companies within companies, in effect. As America would soon learn, these holding companies turned out to be a key step in the development of the great monopolies of the end of the 19th century. More importantly for our story, New Jersey also repealed regulations that required companies to even operate in the state. With the state taking a chunk of revenue from every company registered there, New Jersey regulators had spied another means of making money, even if the companies themselves never did business in New Jersey. All of a sudden, anyone, from Hartford to Houston to Honolulu, could create a New Jersey company, enjoying the state's new benefits without actually setting foot there. Geographic restraints that had previously limited company formation became a thing of the past, and the reaction was swift. As the New York Times reported, needless to say, companies raced to New Jersey. By 1902, its income from taxes and fees on the new corporations was so great that it abolished the property tax. New Jersey watched its state coffers explode. One writer at the time said it was as though a Klondike gold mine had been discovered in New Jersey. The state was soon making enough revenue from those rushing to set up companies that it even began remitting taxes back to local cities. Everyone in the state, it appeared, benefited from New Jersey's corporate reforms. But other states took notice. So many companies uprooted for New Jersey that officials in other states began referring to the Garden State as the Trader State, sucking up taxes and fees the other states suddenly lost out on. And the resultant effect could have, and probably should have, been predicted. The corporate sprint to New Jersey sparked a response from other state governments looking to get their share of this new Klondike gold mine. A renaissance in business-friendly regulations quickly followed, with regulatory rollbacks racing from state to state. Thanks to these turn-of-the-century innovations, as one researcher related, U.S. states found themselves in that race to the bottom, with new laws imposing fewer and fewer restraints on potential corporate abuses. Basic corporate regulations, things like requiring shareholder input or assuming liability for any malfeasance or accidents, suddenly began disappearing across states. And along the way, requirements for publicly identifying those behind the corporations also disappeared. Anonymity, as Delaware would later discover, was a perk that sold well, especially when paired with all of the other corporate regulatory rollbacks. But not everyone in New Jersey appreciated the state's new role as the epicenter of company formation. Woodrow Wilson, serving as the state's governor from 1911 to 1913, was one of those who had second thoughts about New Jersey's transformation. Propelled by a reformist bent and concerned about who might be taking advantage of New Jersey's loose regulations, Wilson clamped down, undoing some of the recent rollbacks. Corporate lobbyists decried Wilson's moves, but their calls fell on deaf ears. While Wilson wasn't able to return New Jersey to a corporate status quo ante, he effectively halted New Jersey's deregulatory momentum. Suddenly, those looking for lax corporate regulation had to turn elsewhere. But they didn't have to look far. Just a few miles south stood Delaware, poised, ready to capitalize on Wilson's decision, and ready to swipe the pro-corporate crown from New Jersey. Delaware, read one article in the American Law Review from the era, was gangrened with envy at the spectacle of the truck patchers, sand duners, clam diggers, and mosquito wafters of New Jersey getting all the money in the country into her coffers, and the state was determined to get her little, tiny, sweet, round baby hand into the grab bag of sweet things before it is too late. Much like today, the Delaware of the early 20th century wasn't known for much. The state maintained a small service sector and an even smaller industrial base. Without any real natural resources or tourist attractions, the state scraped by trying to leech business from those traveling between New York and Washington, D.C. Indeed, there were plenty of similarities between Delaware and New Jersey, at least before the latter's corporate reforms. As such, when Wilson's new policies began to take effect in New Jersey, Delaware saw an opportunity. To be sure, other states also spied the same opportunities, watching New Jersey suddenly turn its back on the corporate gold mine. But Delaware was perfectly placed to profit off New Jersey's decision. The state enjoyed many of the same geographic advantages New Jersey offered, situated as it is between America's financial, New York, and political, Washington, D.C., capitals. "Who wants to fly to Alaska for corporate litigation?" one journalist wrote, highlighting Delaware's prime location. And while Wilson spooked corporate clients and pro-corporate interests with his pro-regulation reforms, Delaware never followed suit. As Delaware Governor Pete DuPont would later say, "You can't trust the Delaware legislature to do a lot of things, but you can rely on it to keep the corporation law up to date." While New Jersey's deregulatory reforms stalled under Wilson, Delaware's state government picked up the baton. It was, in a sense, a move straight out of the story of American capitalism. The state saw an opportunity to attract business and enacted the necessary reforms to make it so. The pro-business ethos that has propelled American capitalism translated into, quite literally, pro-business, pro-corporation, pro-company formation moves in Delaware. None of it was illegal. None of it was even necessarily unexpected. After all, if it hadn't been Delaware, another state would have grasped at the corporate revenue Wilson had pushed out of New Jersey and redirected those corporate fees into their own state budgets, and maybe even reduced tax burdens on happy citizens. Maybe it would have been another small state, like New Hampshire. Maybe it would have been another overlooked state, like Rhode Island. Some state, somewhere else, would have taken similar steps, redirecting that fire hose of corporate fees into their own coffers. But Delaware happened to be the first. The steps Delaware took effectively opened the doors for companies to relocate as easily as possible into the state, enticing them with new pro-corporate laws. In addition to the reforms already implemented in New Jersey, Delaware soon began allowing corporations to reimburse directors for damages incurred if and when upset shareholders filed suit, invaluable protection as America grew more and more litigious. The state also soon began exempting corporations from state taxes, meaning that the new Delaware company's only real connection to or interaction with the state ended the moment the paperwork was filed. But there was one advantage that Delaware held that no other state could provide, which has allowed Delaware to entrench its leading status as a global offshore center well into the 21st century: Delaware's Chancery Court. Birthed in 1792, the Chancery Court has been producing a steady stream of corporate law for nearly as long as the nation itself has existed. Uniquely dedicated to determining the minutiae of Delaware's corporate law, the Chancery Court proved a key weapon in Delaware's pro-corporate arsenal, a tool no other state could match. As a pair of American academics found, this state-level court has provided expert judiciary and an ability to resolve quickly complex business disputes, effectively providing Delaware with a far deeper well of corporate case law than any other state in the country, a godsend for lawyers ever vigilant for any threats their corporate clients may face. By the 1920s, Delaware's position as a leader in the corporate race to the bottom was all but assured. The state, to steal a political science term, had been effectively captured, beholden to its corporate regime and to the revenue brought to the state from the company formation industry. There was also one other advantage Delaware maintained. In a nod to the U.S.'s schizophrenic offshore-onshore status, Delaware managed for years to avoid the reputational taint that more traditional offshore havens suffer from. Delaware doesn't carry the same stigma as the Caymans or Bermuda, North Carolina State University's Bradley Lindsay, who has researched Delaware's status as an offshore haven, said, "Why not attract business to my little state and get something at the expense of the other states?" And why not? By the 1930s, revenue from the companies housed in Delaware amounted to 42% of the state's total revenue. By the dawn of the 2020s, that ratio was largely similar, but the numbers were now stupefying. Every year, Delaware makes nearly $1.5 billion from all those seeking out its corporate-friendly regime. That number is not only far more than any other state, but it's a massive financial crutch for a state that doesn't maintain a sales or property tax. Or look at another number, 1.5 million. That's the approximate number of corporations that are now registered in the state, with over 225,000 now created annually. A century ago, Delaware's reforms were meant to help fund services for its citizens, but given that Delaware doesn't even have a million residents, we're now facing a situation in which, as BYU's Daniel Nielsen said, Delaware legislators' constituents, in a very real sense, are companies. At the turn of the 21st century, Delaware's company formation industry was still working overtime to make sure anyone could set up anonymous shell companies as easily as possible. The state had whittled down wait times for an anonymous shell company to less than an hour, and some places in Delaware even offered expedited services, getting you an anonymous shell company in as little as 10 minutes. Delaware's Office of the Secretary of State, which oversees company formation, even stays open until 10:30 p.m. on Friday nights. Along the way, Delaware became the only state to hire lobbyists to argue against transparency reforms in Washington. And then there's the anonymity. Since, as described above, Washington never managed to grab control of corporate registration from states, and since neither Congress nor state legislatures ever bothered to demand information about the beneficial owners of these companies, Delaware felt free to offer anonymity as one of its pro-corporate services, no matter who wanted it. As one of Delaware's company service providers advertises on its website, those selling anonymous shell companies in Delaware are not required to keep any information on the beneficial owner, and the state of Delaware does not require that the beneficial owner's identity be disclosed. Or, as David Finzer, the chief executive of one of Delaware's major company service providers, said about information on those behind the anonymous shell companies, basically, Delaware requires none. Delaware has the most secret companies in the world and the easiest to form. All of which is to say, Delaware may not itself be a hive of scum and villainy, but it's where the entire hive goes whenever it needs to conceal its finances, cover up its financial tracks, and transform all of its blood money into untraceable assets. Rather than the laboratories of democracy American states purported to be, Delaware's transformation meant that American states had started to become, as scholar Bryce Tuttle noted, laboratories of secrecy. Victor Bout was one of the leading members of the long list of international crime lords who raced to Delaware, building out his operations with the anonymity the state could provide. A scrawny, Tajik-born Russian national with a bushy mustache the size of a clipped cigar, Bout had built an arms trafficking empire amidst the collapse of the Soviet Union. For a taste of Bout's murderous exploits, check out Nicolas Cage's title character in the 2005 film Lord of War, which was based on Bout. Tracing clients and partners from Central America to Central Asia, from warlords in sub-Saharan Africa to proxies working closely with the Taliban, Bout shadowed almost all of the major illicit arms transfers through the 1990s and early 2000s. Fighter jets and anti-aircraft weapons, machine guns and machetes, the products didn't matter. All that mattered was moving merchandise to waiting clients and making sure that those investigating him, including American officials, never uncovered the financial networks that facilitated Bout's arms trafficking work. Bout, nicknamed the Merchant of Death, was eventually picked up in Thailand in 2008 and remains housed in a supermax prison in Illinois, but not before splattering nation after nation with bullets and blood. And as later court documents made clear, much of the butchery left in Bout's wake tracked directly back to anonymous shell companies, including two based in Delaware, right under the noses of American officials who spent years trying to track him down. But Bout was hardly the only globe-trotting criminal to turn to Delaware. Jack Abramoff, perhaps the most notorious lobbyist this side of Paul Manafort, oversaw a sham Delaware company to manage millions in illicit, off-the-books payments between congressional officials and criminal networks elsewhere. Timothy Durham, nicknamed the Midwest Madoff, for conning thousands of elderly investors out of hundreds of millions of dollars, centered his operations in Delaware, as did Stanko Subotic, a Serbian national sentenced to years in prison for his role overseeing international smuggling rings. A Romanian accountant named Laszlo Kiss, who once wrote a book accurately describing the U.S. as a tax haven, apparently got a bit too familiar with his research and allegedly used a series of Delaware shell companies to help hide millions and millions of dollars. The examples are too numerous to count. International criminals and crooked foreign officials, gun smugglers and rhino poachers, human traffickers and inside traders. All of them look to Delaware. And these are just the examples we know about. As one lawyer said in 2017, it's not entirely beyond the realms of possibility that ISIS could be operating companies domiciled in Delaware. All of which points to one clear, inescapable conclusion. Delaware's role as the most corporate-friendly state in the Union and the greatest font of anonymous shell companies the world has ever seen has extracted blood from corporate stones. Much of this has been, as we heard earlier, a direct outgrowth of reforms a century prior, and in that sense, was never predicated on necessarily transforming Delaware into an offshore haven, or in creating the tools that kleptocrats and others would eventually need. But by the time post-colonial and post-Soviet regimes started opening up, the state's offshoring infrastructure, its corporate regulatory regime, the Chancery Court, and the like, were already in place. Figures like S.B. Wu didn't transform Delaware into this offshoring mecca on their own. Instead, officials in the state were perfectly happy to share a range of offshoring and anonymous services that were already in place, regardless of who ended up taking advantage. And there's little evidence that Delaware ever cared much about who was taking advantage anyway. As one of its official websites states, Delaware is not a secrecy haven any more than any other state or the United States itself, which is telling, given that, as the thrust of this book argues, the United States itself is a secrecy haven. And the claim would be laughable if the state's anonymous shell corporations hadn't been linked directly to the deaths of hundreds of thousands, the swindling of billions of dollars, and the looting of entire nations. Nor does it change the fact that, as the Tax Justice Network recently wrote, Delaware is the biggest single source of anonymous corporations in the world. But just as Delaware once knocked New Jersey from its perch, other states watching Delaware rake in billions in corporate fees in recent years have begun putting forth their own financial secrecy reforms. These other states want to attract some of the capital, clean, dirty, it doesn't matter, that Delaware had sponged up. And while they haven't stolen Delaware's crown, they've begun carving out empires of financial anonymity of their own. Fernley, Nevada, lies an hour east of Reno along a stretch of barren desert. The town, a planned community with a population of 20,000, is decades past its prime, with one publication recently describing it as little more than a truck stop town. It does, though, have one claim to international notoriety. Fernley is the home of a company service provider called Nevada Business Incorporated, NBI. Run by Robert Harris, who oversees the business from his beige bungalow, complete with a no-spin zone Fox News doormat greeting visitors, NBI is one of the few companies in this space that has opened its doors to journalists and researchers, offering a peek into why foreign despots and human traffickers look to the U.S., and why, specifically, they would come to a state like Nevada. Sitting in his living room-turned office, Harris, slightly balding and with the kind of wan skin you get from sitting at a computer all day, unspools a tale of why he now sells anonymous shell companies. He used to work as a bartender, he says, helping lubricate all those prospecting for gambling gold. As the years went on and he started getting a bit older, he noticed that club and casino owners kept replacing his coworkers with younger, female employees. He got the message, he says. In 2001, at the age of 50, he left the hospitality business. A friend suggested he explore the nascent world of company service providers, becoming someone who helps set up anonymous shell companies for whoever comes calling. Nearly 20 years later, Harris estimates that he's set up thousands of companies. It's not like it's lavish living, he says, revealing that he only makes mid-five figures annually. He supplements his income by selling books on what he describes as Bible prophecy, with one of his books featuring a cover image of Jesus, wearing a Zorro mask for some reason, juggling a half dozen glowing balls. When asked what his day consists of, Harris talks about rote tasks. He answers the phone or responds to his emails, and he explains to potential clients the details of what an anonymous shell company entails and what it will require of those on the other end of the phone or the email chain. If they're game, Harris tells me, he can set up an anonymous shell company for them in as little as an hour, theirs to do with what they wish. When it comes to the identities of his clients, Harris doesn't pry. If they tell him their names and sources of income, that's fine. But if they don't, well, there's no reason for him to ask. He doesn't need to know, and the less they tell him, the less information he'll have to hide if anyone comes looking. There's no pressure to identify any beneficial owners behind the anonymous shell companies he sets up, Harris tells me. There are no worries. There's no pressure. When I ask about what would happen if, say, someone steering an organized crime syndicate called him up and asked him to set up an anonymous shell company on their behalf, Harris coughs and leans back in his chair. Not everybody in Nevada is a crook, or is looking to hide money, he says. That is true. There's no allegation that any work Harris has done has been illegal, or that Harris has done anything that will land him or any of his clients in prison. Everything that Harris has done has been permissible in the eyes of both the state of Nevada and the federal government. And it's that rhetoric, that the majority of the clients are perfectly fine, perfectly legitimate, that has been a staple of those opposed to counter-kleptocracy reforms for years. These small-time company service providers, where the bankers and realtors and hedge fund providers will meet throughout this book, claim time and again that their industry or their clients are all above-board, legitimate customers looking simply to take advantage of America's capitalistic services. Maybe there are a few bad apples that slip through, but should we upset the entire cart trying to track them down? Should we upend entire American industries, hell, the entire edifice of American capitalism, trying to make sure there's no dirty money slipping through the cracks of the American economy? Harris, then, is hardly an outlier. If anything, Harris's NBI is a microcosm of a trend a few decades in the making, a transformation that hasn't gained as many headlines as Delaware, but one that's been just as disastrous for the rest of us. Nevada has long been associated with all kinds of experiments in modern capitalism, from gambling, to prostitution, to the bizarre electric amoeba that is Las Vegas. As such, Nevada's transformation into a massive offshore haven in its own right fits, like Delaware's, firmly within the state's historical trajectory. Still, Nevada's transformation had to start somewhere. For that, you have to go back a few decades. In the early 1990s, Nevada faced a budget shortfall. Legislators in Carson City got a whiff of what Delaware was shopping around and wanted a slice of the action. Because company formation remained firmly in state hands, Nevada's government began rolling back related regulations. It was, as we've seen, a move that U.S. states had tried time and again. But for Nevada, that budget shortfall kept expanding. By the turn of the century, even with those earlier regulatory rollbacks, the state was still staring at a $130 million hole. And in a state that already lacked personal or corporate income taxes, and that required a two-thirds supermajority to approve any future tax increases, there were only so many roads to revenue generation. As such, officials hit on an idea. Delaware had been an unchallenged capital of financial secrecy for decades. But why couldn't Nevada try to steal the crown? Why not transform Nevada, as the legislators began saying, into the Delaware of the West? The impetus in 1991 was income. The University of Nevada, Las Vegas's Eric Franklin, who studied Nevada's descent into a global financial secrecy haven, told me. There's a lot of literature on the race to the bottom in terms of corporate laws, and by saying Delaware of the West, the code is business-friendly as possible. Repealing the few remaining regulations on corporate formation, including any requirements that might force those behind the anonymous shell companies to reveal themselves, Nevada legislators aimed to open the state to a raft of new money and clients looking for financial anonymity. State legislators, including future Nevada Senator Dean Heller, proposed a motion to allow complete anonymity in shell company formation as part of an educational enhancement package, directing proposed revenue from new anonymous shell company formation to pay for Nevada teachers' salaries. There was really no other option, one person familiar with the motion who, ironically enough, asked to remain anonymous, told me. The motion passed nearly unanimously. All restrictions on who could form a company in the state and what kind of identifying information they needed to provide were eliminated. It was suddenly easier to get an anonymous shell company in Nevada than it was to get a library card. On the budgetary side, the move was a godsend. Two decades later, the revenue from the anonymity has turned into a flood, generating over $100 million for the state annually. It's one of the top revenue generators we have in our state, Franklin told me. It was a genius move, really, with the revenue now going toward funding Nevada's teachers. Who could be against that? Soon, Nevada was raking in millions of dollars in untraceable money, registering tens of thousands of brand new companies without any requirements to identify who was behind them. My Labrador Jack, if he were a natural person, could be a company service provider, one Nevada official said, because he has a Nevada address and is capable of fetching the paper. There was never any explicit chatter in Nevada about how the reforms would attract all kinds of suspect and dirty money looking to be laundered, but it wasn't hard to imagine who would soon be taking advantage. What a terrible message we are now sending to the business world, said Dina Titus, now a member of Congress. We might as well hang out a shingle. Sleazeballs and rip-off artists welcome here. Thanks to Nevada's self-propelled transformation into an offshore haven, one academic said, Nevada has all but hung up a no law for sale sign. Or as Titus added, Nevada has sold its soul. The website for Robert Harris's company, NBI, is a case study in how those regulatory rollbacks have taken root. For as low as $249, Harris offers an anonymous shell company to any and all, to Colombian drug smugglers, to Vietnamese human trafficking rings, to post-Soviet oligarchs trying to interfere in American politics. For a bit more money, you can splurge on Harris's presidential package, which adds an official company seal and even a new bank account. Harris also sells what he describes as nominee or privacy services to eliminate your name completely from the public record. As Harris's website adds, NBI's business principles are derived from faith in Christ. One of Harris's main competitors in Nevada is a company service provider called Incorporate 123. We began in 2000 by offering traditional Nevada incorporation services, Incorporate 123's website reads, noting that they quickly realized that our clients would benefit from services and procedures that were traditionally offered only by offshore service providers. Incorporate 123's specialty is peddling shelf companies. Shell companies created years ago, sitting unused on a digital shelf, offering a patina of legitimacy simply because they're not brand new. Even more than Harris, Incorporate 123 trumpets anonymity at every turn. As the splash quote on Incorporate 123's main page reads, control everything, own nothing. Scrolling down a bit, the site, broken English and all, details the ethos of anonymity. Since 9/11 and the introduction of the USA Patriot Act, and under the guise of anti-money laundering, governments and big corporations have continually demonstrated an ever-increasing disregard for your personal and business privacy. Most Nevada company service providers have simply rolled over and shared their clients' private information upon receiving a simple, and oftentimes not even legal, request from any government agency or powerful corporation. Our conscience would not allow us to roll over, so we internationalized our services in order to give you the privacy that you still deserve. It's unclear what Incorporate 123 means when it claims it internationalized its services. But a 2016 piece in USA Today offers a hint. The paper identified David Batrick as Incorporate 123's head, but quickly discovered that Batrick wasn't even based in Nevada. When contacted, Batrick declined to disclose his country of residence or citizenship, but said it was not the United States. That is to say, one of Nevada's major company service providers doesn't even appear to be a citizen of Nevada or of the United States. Or, put another way, a non-American appears to be running a massive, sprawling operation setting up anonymous American shell companies for anonymous clients without any idea who the clients actually are, or where they're from, or whether any of their financing is tied to human rights violations or the most brutal regimes the world has ever known. In early 2016, thousands of leaked internal documents from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca spilled into the open. Known as the Panama Papers, the leak revealed the details, names, dates, amounts of money, tied to myriad figures around the world who'd turned to the Panamanian firm for help hiding, and in some cases laundering, their money. The names revealed in the leak included prominent politicians from all regions of the world, including British Prime Minister David Cameron, Azerbaijan's despotic leader Ilham Aliyev, and even those hiding money on behalf of Russian dictator Vladimir Putin. The fallout from the revelations was swift. Not only did it prompt Panama to begin cleaning up its own offshoring services industry, the country, like many of its Caribbean neighbors, had served as an offshore jurisdiction for years, but it also helped topple governments from Iceland to Pakistan. The Panama Papers were, and still are, an unprecedented peek behind the offshore curtain. And while much of it centered on Panama's offshoring services, the Panama Papers also provided some insight into who has been taking full advantage of Nevada's sprint toward financial anonymity. One of the things authorities and researchers learned from the reams of documents, those behind Mossack Fonseca, a firm specializing in the secrecy and sorcery of the offshore world, couldn't get enough of Nevada. According to the leaked documents, accountants at Mossack Fonseca had personally helped set up over 1,000 anonymous shell companies in Nevada for their clients, and it wasn't difficult to see why they sent their clients to the state. As one of the leaked documents, pitching Nevada as a potential anonymous home, read, "Non-U.S. persons remain confidential and do not, simply by virtue of owning an interest in a U.S. entity, have to file or disclose their identity." More simply, Mossack Fonseca specifically pitched Nevada to its global clientele because of the state's anonymity, for the fact that no one would ever know who secretly steered the anonymous Nevada shell companies in question. As Mossack Fonseca added, anonymous incorporation in Nevada, where virtually no due diligence is required, was thriving. As the secrets of those Nevada companies tumbled out for all to see, it was clear that Nevada had transformed into that den of sleazeballs and ripoff artists legislators had feared. The corporate records of 1,000-plus Nevada business entities linked to Mossack Fonseca reveal layers of secretive ownership, with few having humans' names behind them and most tracing back to a tiny number of overseas addresses from Bangkok high-rises to post offices on tiny island nations, one examination found. The clients Mossack Fonseca funneled to Nevada spanned the globe. One company listed in the leak, Cross Trading LLC, was allegedly at the center of a bribery scheme involving FIFA, the soccer world's major governing body. Another dozen of the companies tracked back to a family of Thai oligarchs, the Chiratiwat clan, billionaire investors in Thai real estate and developments. Some of the companies were even embroiled in the unfurling oil and bribes embezzlement scandal then rocking Brazilian politics, a scandal that would eventually discredit Brazil's entire ruling class and give rise to the far-right presidency of Jair Bolsonaro. The documents also pulled the curtain back on the lengths to which Mossack Fonseca went to keep its Nevada-based business open, and just how important Nevada was to these global money laundering operations, as one case in particular illustrated. In the early 2010s, billionaire hedge fund manager Paul Singer tried to recoup some $1.7 billion in Argentinian bonds his fund had purchased. Turning down Buenos Aires' offers at restructuring the debt, Singer instead began tracking down Argentinian assets elsewhere, hoping to seize them and use them as leverage in negotiations. Shortly after Singer's efforts got underway, an Argentinian prosecutor revealed that Lázaro Báez, a millionaire businessman close to former Argentine president Néstor Kirchner, was one of the beneficiaries of a multi-million-dollar embezzlement scheme that used hundreds of anonymous shell companies based in Nevada. They all happened to share the same Nevada address as MF Corporate Services, a none-too-subtle nod to Mossack Fonseca, which was then setting up hundreds of similar anonymous shell companies throughout the state. Maybe, Singer thought, there was a way to pry into these companies to identify some of the assets secretly held by Argentinian officials. As journalist Jake Bernstein detailed, Singer's lawyers sat for a 7-hour deposition in 2014 with Patricia Amunategui, the woman helping run MF Corporate Services. Amunategui spent the entire interview denying that she worked for Mossack Fonseca. Instead, she claimed, Mossack Fonseca had nothing to do with MF Corporate Services or with any of the 100-plus companies suddenly tied to the embezzling scheme swirling around Argentina's former president. Remarkably, Jürgen Mossack, the company's namesake, backed her up, saying that Mossack Fonseca and MF Corporate Services were entirely separate entities. For Singer, it was a dead end. That cloak of anonymity had stalled his efforts, forcing him to move on. But not long after, the Panama Papers revealed that the two companies were, as Singer suspected, one and the same, and that they had helped Argentina's corrupt elite use Nevada to stash and launder their embezzled loot. The leak also revealed the links to which Mossack Fonseca went just to keep its Nevada pipeline open. Mossack Fonseca's IT manager wrote in one of the leaked documents that he'd called Amunategui shortly after her deposition, discussing ways to build more distance between the two offices, Bernstein recounted. Mossack Fonseca promptly began separating Amunategui's computer system from Mossack Fonseca's overall operations and proceeded to scrape logs from Amunategui's computer wholesale, all to make sure the links between Mossack Fonseca and Nevada were obscure to the investigators, as the IT manager wrote. It even flew another of its employees to Nevada directly, where he cleaned up everything and brought all documents to Panama. For a while, those efforts worked. Mossack Fonseca's Nevada pipeline lived on, with no one, from officials in Washington to individuals like Singer, any the wiser. But then, in early 2016, the Panama Papers exploded into the world and revealed all the sordid details of Mossack Fonseca's anonymous shell company operations. They offered granular details of the symbiotic relationship between Nevada and Mossack Fonseca and all of the autocrats and criminals they serviced. And they also revealed a link to another state, one of the other main cogs in America's descent into an offshore mecca, and one that helped introduce the world to the most popular means of money laundering in the first place. Frank Burke never imagined that his primary legacy would lie in the art of offshoring. As a wildcat oil driller working across the Western Hemisphere in the 1970s, the last thing Burke was interested in, as those familiar with the man told me, was helping provide the world's crooked and corrupt with the perfect means of anonymity. He just wanted to drill, and to support his family, and to make sure he and his business were protected from potential suits and damages along the way, especially from the deep-pocketed oil and gas competitors driving Burke and his wildcatters into extinction. Harried by the major energy companies trying to dominate as many markets as they could, Burke and his teams of drillers had an idea. They'd discovered a company structure in Panama called a limitada. It was deceptively simple. Not only did it shield owners from corporate liability, limiting damages and potential lawsuits from any and all, but it qualified under Panamanian law for preferential tax benefits, which wildcatters like Burke were always on the lookout for to cut rising costs. At the time, there wasn't anything comparable in the U.S. To Burke, that didn't make sense. Why couldn't the U.S. set up something that would limit liability like this? Why couldn't U.S. states let him set up some kind of limited liability company? With that thought, the modern LLC was born. The same LLC structure we see everywhere, across too many industries to name, often used for perfectly legitimate means. It's a structure that offers protections to proprietors, saving them from debilitating lawsuits, limiting their liability if their company goes sideways. But those protections don't extend just to legitimate entrepreneurs. As we'll see, they also protect the kinds of oligarchs and corrupt figures sniffing around for anonymity and for even further protections for their dirty money. But first, Burke had to convince legislators that the LLC was an idea that could work. In the mid-1970s, Burke returned to the U.S. to pitch his idea, looking for a state legislature he could easily lobby. Alaska, with the lowest population of any state, seemed promising. Think about it. In Alaska and Wyoming, it's a whole lot easier to get to the legislators and go have coffee, or go hunt or whatever, than getting to New York or California and penetrating their legislature. Susan Hamill, a law professor at the University of Alabama, who interviewed Burke before he died in 2010, told me. But his idea eventually died in the Alaskan legislature, weighed down by partisan squabbles. Still, Burke didn't give up. Instead, he uprooted for Wyoming, and as Hamill said, the Wyoming folks welcomed them with open arms. Burke took legislators out for coffee, took them hunting, and pitched them his plan for what he called a limited liability company, or LLC for short. And the Wyoming legislators, in 1977, bit. It wasn't difficult for them to see the benefits. In a nod to the decades of corporate innovation U.S. states like Delaware had already seen, Wyoming legislators realized they could use these LLCs to entice new corporate clients to the state, potentially reaping millions in fees from the new companies that bloomed. And if they could bundle these LLC structures with the kind of anonymity more and more voices were demanding, all the better. To be sure, an LLC is an incredibly common corporate structure and often used for perfectly legitimate means. Most small companies rely on LLC structures to facilitate their business, given not only how easy they are to set up, but also, as Burke and others realized, because they help shield them from debilitating lawsuits that could have previously ruined those small operators. hence the limited liability in the name. Just because you come across an LLC does not mean that the company is operating as an offshore vehicle or is part of a broader money laundering enterprise. But even while Burke and his Wildcatters were happy, others soon realized that Burke's innovation could be used for something else entirely. All Burke had wanted was a means of protecting his business and his few clients and the few remaining Wildcatters he worked with. Instead, he, with the help of the Wyoming legislature, gifted the world the perfect variant of the anonymous shell company. They weren't looking to facilitate the hiding of the true identity of real estate owners, of moving wealth offshore to make it harder to tax, Hamill said, but that's exactly what happened. These LLC company structures offer increased protections against things like lawsuits by distancing the owner from the company, one of the primary reasons LLCs tend to dominate the market when it comes to anonymous shell companies. There's a reason our Hiding Money LLC, anonymous American shell company from the previous chapter, was an LLC. If you're a kleptocrat interested in anonymous U.S. shell companies, you want the one that will offer the most protections from prying eyes or from potential fallout. Enter the LLC. In just a few years, as the following sections will detail, Burke's LLCs had taken on offshoring lives of their own. As Hamill said, if Burke saw what his LLC had since become, Frank would roll over in his grave. Wyoming's story is, in many ways, the exact same one that played out in Delaware and Nevada. States looking for ways to increase revenue realized they could start offering offshore and financial anonymity services, and that there was a clear market available for such services. Wyoming state legislators and company service providers began pitching Wyoming as the state that invented the LLC, and thousands of anonymous shell companies and millions of dollars in revenue soon followed. Wyoming, like Delaware and Nevada, realized it had struck corporate gold. And Wyoming, also like Delaware and Nevada, only became more and more enraptured with this new revenue stream, and more reliant on the fees raked in from setting up these anonymous shell companies, no matter who was behind them. To be sure, there are a few quirks in Wyoming that set it apart. The state doesn't have a corporate income tax, yet another corporate draw, and it allows all company records to be kept outside the state, and even out of the country. What better way to assure anonymity than by keeping your Wyoming corporate records in, say, Turkmenistan? These were all part of the state's secrecy perks, one investigator said. And those secrecy perks clearly worked. As one company service provider in Wyoming said, anyone can say they are anybody. In the 4 decades since Burke's idea took root, there are now tens of thousands of LLCs swamping the state, which means there's now about one business entity for every household in Wyoming, which remains America's smallest state in terms of population size. Wyoming also boasts some of the cheapest anonymous shell company fees in the country, driving prices as low as $100 just to set one up. I think the biggest reason we've been doing so well is because setting up an anonymous shell company is so cheap, Dan Zwanitzer, a state representative from Cheyenne, told me. We make it a little more difficult than other states to search shareholders, so you can only search by the company's name. If you're just trying to find individuals, you can't search by an individual's name. You have to know the name of their company, and if they have a weird company name, you're never going to find them. We call it, Zwanitzer adds, business friendly. And all of those developments began attracting serious flows of dirty money to the state in the mid-1990s. Many of those funds came, unsurprisingly, from the shattered Soviet Union, which had fractured only a few years prior. One of those attracted to the state was Pavlo Lazarenko, whose corruption placed Wyoming on the global kleptocratic map and kickstarted a flow of dirty post-Soviet money that people like Ihor Kolomoisky, who we met in the prologue, would soon take full advantage of. Lazarenko, jolly, often seen wearing ill-fitting suits, served as Ukraine's prime minister for a few years in the mid-1990s. Like many of that initial post-Soviet generation, he was more interested in dipping into state coffers, extending his links of corrupt networks, and entrenching his own power bases through whatever crooked means he could. During his time as prime minister, Lazarenko skimmed significant proceeds from Ukraine's gas transit, capitalizing on Ukraine's role as a middleman between Russia and the European Union, It's an easy scheme to pull off, as we'll see later on. By all appearances, Lazarenko was wildly successful when it came to swindling money that should have gone to Ukrainian citizens. According to Transparency International, Lazarenko pilfered and laundered hundreds of millions of dollars during his tenure, enough to place him among the 20th century's greatest kleptocrats, sharing space with Indonesia's Suharto and the Democratic Republic of Congo's Mobutu Sese Seko. Lazarenko's graft, though, eventually caught up with him. Ousted in 1997 and facing corruption charges at home, Lazarenko attempted to hide out in the U.S., waiting for the furor over his fraud to die down. But American authorities didn't go along, and soon filed money laundering charges of their own against Lazarenko. Held in California, Lazarenko was sentenced by an American court in 2009 to 8 years in prison, alongside a forfeiture order totaling $30 million. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Lazarenko's sentence should send a strong message to corrupt foreign public officials. They will be held accountable if they misuse their office and try to make safe harbor in the United States. It turns out that message fell on deaf ears, as Obiang and Kolomoisky and the entire past decade have illustrated. Lazarenko's conviction was welcome news in Washington and in Kyiv, but it revealed a parallel reality that those corrupt foreign public officials had long known. As court documents revealed, Lazarenko had funneled and laundered tens of millions of dollars in the heart of the U.S., right in a small brick home in residential Cheyenne, Wyoming. This nondescript house, nestled in a sleepy part of a sleepy town, was actually home to thousands of anonymous shell companies. The walls of the main room are covered floor to ceiling with numbered mailboxes labeled as corporate suites, Reuters found in 2011. It was, they added, a little Cayman island on the Great Plains. The house, set between a church and a barber shop, as I found when I later visited, held Wyoming Corporate Services, one of Wyoming's leading company service providers. As with others in Nevada and Delaware, Wyoming Corporate Services pledged to protect the anonymity of all. A corporation is a legal person created by state statute that can be used as a fall guy, a servant, a good friend, or a decoy. A person you control, yet cannot be held accountable for its actions, Wyoming Corporate Services wrote on its website. The language wasn't as jarring as another Wyoming company service provider, whose website screamed that your name is on nothing, and that they could provide complete companies by tomorrow morning. It's unclear why they felt the need to shout at readers and potential customers. The man behind Wyoming Corporate Services was a local named Gerald Pitts. Pitts later told reporters that he fully recognized that the LLCs his company set up may be used for both good and ill, which was at least more than most company service providers would admit. But Pitts apparently didn't care, revealing that he would go so far as to set up bank accounts for his anonymous clients and would sometimes even add lawyers as company directors for his clients in order to provide a layer of attorney-client privilege that no investigator could ever crack. All of these schemes, Pitts insisted, were perfectly legal. And in that sense, he was perfectly right. Everything Pitts did for Lazarenko was legally above board, and in the eyes of both Wyoming and the U.S., completely permissible. But that's little comfort to the millions of Ukrainians who watched Lazarenko bleed their state dry, swiping hundreds of millions of dollars that could have gone toward things like schools or first responders or, as Ukraine would learn in 2014, a desiccated military that Russian forces steamrolled on their way to the annexation of Crimea and to everything that has come since. That, though, was all in the future. While Lazarenko stood in court and the details of his Wyoming exploits spilled out, Mossack Fonseca, just as it did with Nevada, was simultaneously directing clients to the state, telling them that Wyoming provided robust protections for the assets with no state taxes levied on offshore and banking transactions. Wyoming wasn't quite as popular with Mossack Fonseca's clientele as Nevada, with only a few hundred of the state's shells linked to the Panamanian firm. But when the 2016 Panama Papers leaked, the revelations appeared to rattle Wyoming officials even more than their counterparts in Nevada. Shortly after the Panama Papers first flooded out, officials in Cheyenne announced a formal audit of Mossack Fonseca's official Wyoming subsidiary, MF Corporate Services Wyoming. That company was itself managed by another company service provider named AAA Corporate Services, whose office sits in the heart of Cheyenne's spare downtown, one of a dozen different offices for corporate service providers, which continued to spread like a fungus throughout the entire city. The state's audit found that MF Corporate Services Wyoming had failed to maintain the required statutory information for a company service provider. As such, the state announced it was shuttering MF Corporate Services Wyoming. The move appeared to be the start of Wyoming finally cracking down on the anonymity coursing through the state. But then, nothing else happened. In fact, state officials promptly went back to writing legislation to help shore up all the anonymous protections. In a stunning statement, Ed Murray, Wyoming's Secretary of State, claimed that Wyoming will not compromise the privacy of our customers. Astoundingly, Murray didn't offer to consider changes to Wyoming corporate oversight structures or even to study the issue. Rather, Murray announced that any calls to increase transparency in Wyoming would be completely ignored. Where other American officials paid lip service to transparency and reform, Murray didn't even bother with those niceties and instead fell back on the deregulatory, pro-business ethos that had propelled so many of these kleptocratic developments. The release of the Panama Papers has led to some renewed calls for transparency and the revealing of beneficial ownership information for entities registered not just in Wyoming, but across the United States, Murray said. Such a move would increase red tape and limit business formation and innovation in Wyoming. Murray concluded, in a statement entirely at odds with reality, that Wyoming, alongside Delaware and Nevada, has been the most proactive in directly confronting those same concerns related to improper use of shell companies. No mention of the oligarchs racing to the state, or findings from researchers about how wide open the state remained to anyone with even a modicum of dirty money. Even after the biggest offshore bombshell the world had ever seen, officials in these states had flipped the findings on their head. Rather than reform, they lied as baldly and broadly as they could, and pledged to change absolutely nothing. Anonymous American shell companies, those building blocks of modern kleptocracy, would continue on as ever. They could continue providing anonymity to any oligarch or regime insider or cartel head or human slaver who wanted it, allowing them to open bank accounts and purchase billions in assets or bankroll political campaigns with funds that could never be traced back to them, let alone return to the victims they continued to immiserate. And it wouldn't take long for others out of Ukraine to imitate Lazarenko's model, and to show just how easy it would be to trace the rot of America's kleptocratic transformation directly to the implosion of small towns across the American Midwest, directly to the gutting of major American metropolises, and directly into the White House itself.